This is DomesticPreparedness.com. Since 1998, Domestic Preparedness has been a source of solutions for the professional preparedness community. Your host today is the managing editor, John Morton.
This audio interview is sponsored by IntelliGuard, protecting lives and property from battlefields to boulevards. Powerful and comprehensive CBRN response solutions, fire suppression, and hazmat remediation systems. For more information, visit www.intelagard.com.
Domestic Preparedness is with Dr. Michael Fraser, the Deputy Executive Director for the National Association of County and City Health Officials. NACHO represents almost 3,000 local public health departments in the United States. And among its national work of interest to domestic preparedness subscribers is its development of guidance and performance standards in bioterrorism preparedness for local public health systems. Today, we're going to talk about that and some other topics of interest that are related to pandemic preparedness. Dr. Fraser, thanks for hosting us here at your headquarters in Washington, D.C.
You're welcome, John. It's great to have you here.
Well, Mike, let's start with the overview of NACHO's work in the bioterrorism preparedness field. Would you tell us a little bit about some of the recent NACHO activities worth highlighting here that are benefiting the local first responders and first receivers, public health officials, and emergency response agencies?
Sure, John. NACHO's been working in emergency preparedness actually since 1999. We were first funded through the Centers for Disease Control to work on the Health Alert Network, which was a project to rapidly communicate health warnings and alerts to health departments across the country. That started before 9/11, before all the real current interest in emergency preparedness from all sectors. And with our Health Alert Network project, we were able to start a project to fund local health departments directly to work on emergency preparedness. And that was the beginning of our Advanced Practice Center program. We're working now in a variety of different ways to support our local health departments across the country. What initially started as a way for health departments to communicate rapidly with one another has turned into a huge portfolio here at NACHO, not just in how health departments can communicate within their community and between communities and with the CDC and other health officials around the country, but also we offer a variety of guidance with regards to how local health departments can plan for emergencies, all hazards approaches, and then specific tools around pandemic influenza preparedness. We offer trainings on the Incident Command System and the National Incident Management System, both CD-ROM and in-person. We also have a variety of different projects that are specific around different kinds of things like the Strategic National Stockpile and how that should work at the local level. So we have a huge portfolio of preparedness programs that I think will be applicable not just to health departments, but those folks who work with health departments in their communities every day.
In this segment, I want to pick up on some of the issues and programs you touched upon in your overview in the previous segment. So let's go right to the Surgeon General's Medical Reserve Corps program. This August, NACHO was awarded the cooperative agreement to support the MRC program. Now, for those who aren't already familiar with the MRC program, Mike, would you detail for us that program and the NACHO support for it?
Sure, John. The Medical Reserve Corps, or the MRC program, is something that we're really excited about. As you mentioned, we were awarded a cooperative agreement, but we've been working with the Medical Reserve Corps program and the Office of the Surgeon General for several years now. The Medical Reserve Corps are volunteer units of health professionals and folks that can support a health response. And MRCs are community-based. They're an asset at the local level. And there are a variety of teams out there, the variety of different acronyms for different kinds of volunteer health units. But the Medical Reserve Corps program is unique because it's focused on building local public health volunteer capacity. We worked with the Office of the Surgeon General to develop a number of different tools for the Medical Reserve Corps program. The current cooperative agreement is for NACHO to provide direct support to the Medical Reserve Corps across the country. The unit started about 3 or 4 years ago as a demonstration project, And the goal was within 5 years to reach 500 MRCs. Well, I checked online today, and there's 522 units with 105,000 volunteers involved. So the program has already met its goal about a year early. What's changed for the Medical Reserve Corps units is the demonstration project included some funding, about $50,000 per unit when it was initially developed. That funding, after 3 years, is no longer available. And so a lot of these MRC units that were initially funded in the pilot program are now looking to sustain what they've developed. Plus, we have the addition of about 350, 370 new units that weren't ever funded at all. And so working with the Office of the Surgeon General, we are going to be providing some direct capacity building support for MRC units that apply. It's not a huge amount of money. It's about a $10,000 award, but it's certainly going in the right direction to keep these units going, to keep them growing, and make sure that they have some ability to sustain that volunteer capacity at the local level.
Now, those are the so-called capacity development mini-grants, correct?
That's right. They're capacity development mini-grants, and what MRC units need to do is visit the www.nacho.org website and look at the guidance on how to apply for those funds. Like I said, $10,000 can add a lot to a volunteer effort in a community.
Sure.
It's not going to necessarily, you know, pay for the full-time coordinator, but it's going to give them some ability to continue their work. And we tried to keep the requirements for that $10,000 to be as simple as possible. We're asking that units continue to update their profiles online so that they work with the Office of the Surgeon General to make sure that all their contact information is correct. We're asking that units begin to provide a plan for how they use the $10,000. But other than that, there aren't a lot of limitations on how individual units can use those funds. There will be a review process, so it's not an automatic award. But we're hoping that we'll be able to fund almost all MRC units this year.
Oh, that's great. Well, now, you mentioned in the previous segment your work in NIMS compliance. Talk to us a little bit about that as it relates to how the MRCs need to work towards that.
Sure. Well, one reason that we were really interested in the Medical Reserve Corps project was because we want to make sure that all of the emergency preparedness assets in a community are coordinated with one another in a comprehensive response plan. And I think as we've all come to know about NIMS, the National Incident Management System, and understand it, it's really about responders working together. It's about a coordinated local, state, and ultimately federal response plan. And NIMS is a framework to do that. So within the Medical Reserve Corps program and in our work planning and providing resources to other kinds of units across the country and local health departments, we are stressing that all those activities be NIMS compliant, which really means that resources, that plans are coordinated with one another, that MRC units are part of a local response, not separate from that, that local health departments fit in with an overall emergency management agency's countywide plan or citywide plan, and those roll logically into a statewide plan so that we're using the same terms, we're using the same names for things, and that planning assumptions are shared among all responders. So for a MRC unit to be NIMS compliant, it's kind of a trick question because communities are NIMS compliant. But everybody needs to get on board with NIMS to understand what it's all about and what their part in making that coordinated response is. And that's why we're asking MRC units to take NIMS seriously, to learn things like ICS, to fit into the county-wide plan and become part of that overall response.
Now, you all are also involved in technical assistance assessments. Tell us a little bit about what's involved with the MRC unit technical assistance assessment?
Sure. The technical assistance assessments are a way for the Office of the Surgeon General to better understand the kinds of needs that Medical Reserve Corps units have across the country. So the plan with the technical assistance assessments is to look at where MRCs need some more guidance. What kinds of issues or topics are they needing more information on? For example, sustainability is a big one. How can you sustain your MRC unit over the years? And by working with the Office of the Surgeon General and other MRC units, they hope to compile a series of technical assistance products that will be useful to MRCs and other kinds of volunteer units.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, NATCHO has partnered with the MRC program to facilitate the core competencies for the MRC volunteers and the development of standards for the volunteers. You're developing a set of 8 core competencies to be adopted nationwide. Mike, would you detail what's involved here, if you would?
Sure. The core competencies were developed to address what we see as a common problem when you work at the local level. And that is, we used to say, you've seen one health department, that it's a real mixed bag when it comes to capacities and competencies in local public health departments. Well, the same is true for Medical Reserve Corps units. We have to remember these are local assets, and this is a big country, and it's really diverse, and what we need here in Washington is going to be very different from what they need out west in Washington State, for example. Mm-hmm. So competencies are a way for everybody to get on the same page, to be able to demonstrate we can do things in a standard way and define what we can expect individuals to do. So working with the Medical Reserve Corps program and the Office of the Surgeon General and a wonderful group of experts who rolled up their sleeves and really hammered out this development process, that group came up with 8 different core competencies for Medical Reserve Corps volunteers. And when you look at the list of core competencies, which I hope folks do, you'll see it's not complicated stuff, but they really are things that we want to make sure every single MRC unit volunteer can do.
Mm-hmm.
Simple things like have an emergency response plan, for example. Simple things like know when and when not to talk to the media in an emergency. That kind of thing. So that diversity of MRC units, which makes the program so rich, is also turned into a real benefit for the program, that everybody knows that when the MRC from Smith County next door flies down to Katrina, everybody has the same expectations of what MRC volunteers can do and begin to standardize how we do things within the MRC program.
In this segment, let's turn now to talking about your advanced practice centers, the APCs. My understanding is that these are the local health departments that are developing the cutting-edge tools and resources for nationwide preparedness and response and recovery. Now, we're talking about national preparedness for a bioterrorist event or disease outbreak of national significance. That's right, yeah?
That's right, yeah. The advanced practice centers, or the APCs, developed, like I said earlier, back in 1999, we started that program. And that was when bioterrorism was a huge concern. Obviously, it still is today. But their focus was on bioterrorism preparedness. And after 9/11 and some of the examination of our overall preparedness, the advanced practice centers and many other preparedness programs switched to an all-hazards framework. So advanced practice centers are working at both bioterrorism preparedness as well as preparedness for other kinds of terrorism and naturally occurring disasters. The Advanced Practice Center started with 3 local health departments directly funded by the Centers for Disease Control to begin to explore what it means to be innovative and cutting edge in the field of public health preparedness. That program, like I mentioned, has grown. We now have 8 sites. They're located across the country, and they are supposed to be and are laboratories for us to develop and test and experiment with public health preparedness activities that we can then take and share with all health departments, whether they're APCs or not, across the country. It's really a neat idea. It's a set of 8 different local health agencies whose budgets are supplemented so that they can actually go out and develop all those things that we've been wishing we had or someone would take on as a project. Well, that's what they're designed to do. And They even go out and make mistakes. Mm-hmm. And we learn from those mistakes so that the other 2,992 health departments don't make the same mistakes. But I'm happy to say that they have developed a lot more successes. Mm-hmm. A lot of what we have in our portfolio of preparedness tools and resources for health departments and for other kinds of emergency responders comes from our advanced practice center laboratories across the country.
Now, with those eight centers, where exactly are they? Do they conform to the regional public health?
Yes, they do. We've hoped to have 10, because mm-hmm. there's 10 Department of Health and Human Services regions. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we have eight right now. We're looking to fund two more. We'd like mm-hmm. to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. But the eight that we have now are located in Cambridge, Massachusetts, mm-hmm. Which is a neat example in the New England region, where they have very small towns, and every town has a Board of Health. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, there's 352 Boards of Health, health departments. Mm-hmm. Cambridge is one of those. And they're looking at how can we develop public health capacity on a regional basis mm-hmm. so that we don't develop 352 separate health department plans, but mm-hmm. instead can work together. Another really neat activity up in Region 2 in New York is the Western New York Public Health Alliance. They're an advanced practice center looking mm-hmm. at how they can coordinate the resources of eight different counties together mm-hmm. in this laboratory. Mm-hmm. DeKalb County in Georgia, which happens to be in the backyard of our Centers for Disease Control, mm-hmm. Has done a lot in that region with other states in the southeast. Mm-hmm. But all of the APC's work applies to the whole country. They're not sure. specifically focused in each of those areas. DeKalb has worked on a really neat program to get students involved mm-hmm. in outbreak response, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. also a campaign called Local Heroes, which is focusing on getting health department personnel to see themselves as part of a local response in, sure. in a new mm-hmm. and different kind of way. Our fourth advanced practice center is in Hennepin County, which is in the Minneapolis area up mm-hmm. in Minnesota. And they've been doing a lot of work on environmental health preparedness, which mm-hmm. is a neat twist and something that I think we're continuing to develop. A lot of those restaurant inspectors might be our frontline disease investigators sure. in a bioterrorism yeah. event. So it's really neat to have that focus. Tarrant County, Texas, which is in that Dallas-Fort Worth megaplex area down in Texas, has done some incredible work on public health informatics, syndromic surveillance activities, and also did a huge exercise at a speedway down there, which was led by a number of different partners in emergency management, but brought together all kinds of folks to respond to a explosion at a speedway down there and thinking through how to get public health more involved in those kinds of events. Santa Clara, California, is working on a number of different projects as well. Out west, they've got a lot of experience with natural disasters, but they're also looking at how do we bring that natural disaster experience together with some of the routine public health activities that they do. So they have some neat programs around mm-hmm. integrating emergency response partners and thinking through some of the unusual ways to get the medical community involved in preparedness, which is really, really important. And then we have our Seattle, Washington, Seattle King County Advanced Practice Center, which has done a lot of work on pandemic influenza, isolation and quarantine, and some of the legal aspects of that. And our eighth site is right here in our own backyard, Montgomery County, Maryland, which has a unique role in the National Capital Region, thinking through all of the different kinds of preparedness activities that would be necessary in this area, which is pretty mind-boggling when you think of all the jurisdictions and agencies here. So we've got eight great places. We'd like to have two more to fill out our portfolio, but they're excellent places to learn from and share with.
Well, let's look at a couple of the examples, drill down a little deeper. Santa Clara in California. Now, that APC, I understand, offers a county medical response system sustainability and capacity building plan. And that brings together diverse community agencies for a coordinated response to, say, a large-scale medical disaster. Can you tell us a little bit what the elements are for that?
Yeah, sure. The CMRS, or the Countywide Medical Response System, is really a neat example of the kind of things that the advanced practice centers were funded to do. It's one of those things that everybody should do, and many people probably are doing in their communities. And in that respect, it might not be the most unique or breathtaking program, mm-hmm. but that little extra resource that they have as an advanced practice center has allowed them to write it up, to think about how to share their story with others so that exactly. they can replicate mm-hmm. it, and given them them that extra boost to kind of talk more about it and get folks to think more strategically. So the CMRS is a collaborative effort. It's led by the Santa Clara County Public Health Department, and it brings together a number of diverse agencies out there in that county, which is in Silicon Valley. It's a really interesting place and has a lot of neat challenges. And what it's done is laid out an integrated approach to emergency management and medical planning so that they were faced with the same problems that many people were faced. Every agency was developing its own preparedness plan. And through the development of the CMRS, they pulled back and said, wait a sec, we're in one county, we're in this all together. Let's get a standard set of requirements together for our planning. Let's build on our diversity, but use that as an opportunity to come up with a real comprehensive plan rather than everybody developing their own approach. So through the CMRS, they've been able to do a number of coordinated planning activities. They've been able to write up some of the successes that they've had so that others can replicate them. And the local health department coordinates it. Emergency management planning is like herding cats sometimes. Everybody's out doing their own thing, and having that opportunity to lead that effort and a little extra resource to bring folks together was really what the APCs in Santa Clara brought to the table.
Well, there was another item that caught my interest out there in Santa Clara, the Medical Volunteers for Disaster Response Planning Toolkit. Now, tell me how this helps increase a community's immediate medical response capabilities.
Sure. Well, we know that in a public health disaster and any kind of disaster, there's never enough people and never enough people to help for all the work that needs to get done. And what Santa Clara has done, which is real similar to the Medical Reserve Corps program, is think through how can we tap the resources that we have in our community, those retired health professionals, those people that have a medical licensure but may not be practicing today. How can we increase the number of health professionals, the folks we know we're going to need in a medical emergency? Prepare them now. Train them now. Check their credentials now, so that when the ball drops, if there is another huge earthquake or hurricane or flu outbreak, all those folks are ready to help, know their role, and the health department has done the due diligence it needs to make sure that volunteers are assisting in their response, are in fact who they say they are, and are credentialed to do that, which is a huge problem.
Mike, you know, your response there brings to mind a question I'd like to ask you. What have you guys done about credentialing for health officials and, you know, the approaches that you're recommending?
It's a really complicated question, John, and the work involved in checking credentials and making sure that people who say that they're doctors or nurses really are doctors or nurses is a problem that we've learned a lot about since Katrina. How states credential their healthcare workforce is different. We have 50 states and 50 different ways of doing it. But what's a really neat partnership between local agencies and state agencies is the ESAR-VIP program, which is a hard acronym to say. It's the Emergency System for the Advanced Registration of Volunteer Health Professionals. The ESAR-VIP program, which is run out of HRSA, the Health Resources and Services Administration, is working with the states to identify a system that we could all use to register healthcare volunteers, to check credentials and licensures before emergencies happen. And so our position is really, while locals need to make sure that individuals say they are who they say they are, it's a local, state, and federal partnership to verify that and to begin to standardize some of that. It's a complicated process, but I think that through the ESAR-VIP program and through working with HRSA, there's a lot of great connections that can be made between the medical community, the public health community, and the emergency management community.
Yeah, well, we talked a little bit with Commander Melissa Saunders at HRSA about that, and yeah, it certainly is a big issue. Now, in this last segment, I want to address with you pandemic influenza planning. What are some of the key issues that NACHO feels should be considered for inclusion in a local jurisdiction's pandemic influenza plan?
Pandemic influenza, and the thought of that is a scary one. When you play out the scenarios, the pan flu scenarios, it's a pretty daunting task to plan for pan flu. We think that no one is going to be able to respond by themselves to a pan flu to a pandemic. There's a lot of assumptions and a lot of planning insights that folks need to share when thinking about pandemic influenza. First off, any case or any outbreak of pandemic influenza is going to be a local, state, federal, and international problem. Mm-hmm. And so some of the mutual aid agreements that we count on for isolated kinds of emergencies or real specific kinds of outbreaks, those are going to go out the window because you're not going to be able to call the county next door to come help you. So thinking through mutual aid or not having mutual aid in a pandemic is going to be really important, because folks are going to have to stay home and take care of individuals in their communities. And it's going to be real difficult to share resources between jurisdictions in a pandemic. I think that we haven't seen a pandemic for a long time here in the United States, a pandemic of influenza or any other contagious disease for that matter. Mm-hmm. And we're not prepared for the kind of change that we're going to need to make in our lives, our daily lives, in a pandemic. How many of us stay home for weeks at a time? Mm-hmm. What does that mean for churches, for stores, for schools, for all kinds of sectors of the economy if we're not able to congregate and meet one another? So you can imagine that trying to enforce some of the classic public health interventions like isolation and quarantine are going to be real tough, mm-hmm. and really important. Our experience with that is we don't really have it. Mm-hmm. We're lucky in the sense that we've not had that kind of an outbreak of that scope in a really long time, but in some ways we've become real complacent about that. Some of the things that we haven't thought about is if we do have everybody practicing some of these social distance and isolation strategies, how do we continue to work? How do we provide food and some of the other necessities for folks that are homebound? Real complicated. We learned a lot from SARS in Toronto, mm-hmm.
yeah.
and that was about 3,000 people. Well, 300 million people here in the United States alone, that's going to be a really different animal. There will be waves of pandemic. It's not over in 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And most of the models I've seen would be an 18 to 24 month outbreak. Mm-hmm. And if H5N1 is the virus, that's a real different virus from the everyday flu that we get this time of year and sometimes can even make it to work and share it with others. H5N1 is more likely to affect folks in the young adult to middle age bracket, which is real different from seasonal influenza, which is real dangerous for the elderly and the young. So even just the modeling and what we have to plan for and with is different in a pandemic. There's going to be a real short supply of medications. And I think that focusing on antivirals and vaccines is a mistake, frankly. There's never going to be enough medicine for everybody. We're going to have to go back to that classic public health toolkit and look at what worked in 1918 and maybe modernize a few of those techniques. But the way that we communicate and the directions that we give people about staying at home and quarantine and isolation are going to be our most successful strategies in pandemic. So there's a lot of factors involved in pandemic influenza. And pandemic influenza is going to be a huge topic at our upcoming February Preparedness Summit. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We have a number of different concurrent sessions, plenary speakers, workshops on pandemic influenza. It's on everybody's mind right now, mm-hmm. and we haven't even seen a case. Mm-hmm. So A lot of effort is going into pandemic influenza planning, both within public health, within Homeland Security, and within a number of other emergency management agencies in the medical community especially. We don't have enough hospital capacity right now to deal with a real severe seasonal influenza outbreak. We know that EMS diversions take place in jurisdictions throughout flu season because ERs are filled to the brim with flu patients. I can't imagine what that's going to look like if we have a pandemic influenza outbreak. So a lot to think about with PanFlu.
Mike, you had mentioned that the Seattle King County, Washington APC was working pandemic issues, and I think also the Santa Clara County APC. What sort of cutting-edge learning laboratories work is going on there where they're developing and testing the tools To help other LHDs tackle the all-hazard preparedness. And I think these two, as I said, have notably produced comprehensive but very different plans addressing pandemic flu. Can you give us some of the details there?
Yeah, the Seattle, King County, and Santa Clara County Advanced Practice Centers worked with us here at NACHO to develop a planning guidance for local public health departments around PanFlu. And it's really a neat resource. If folks visit our website, the www.nacho.org website, you'll see a copy, and it's free. Help yourselves. The point of their work was to take the best of both of those county plans and put it into a comprehensive, easy-to-digest, and useful planning guidance for pandemic influenza. I mentioned earlier that local health departments are different and jurisdictions are different. We're never going to be able to create a cookbook that everyone's just going to be able to open up and put the ingredients together and have a pandemic influenza plan. But by looking at what Seattle King did and Santa Clara have done with PanFlu planning, we took the best of both of their plans and worked with them to synthesize that into a guidance that could be useful for all local health departments. It's a great example of the kind of tools that the Advanced Practice Centers program mm-hmm. has developed, but also the kind of useful tools that we want to get in the hands of local health departments and their partners across the country. It's definitely a neat tool. I would welcome everybody to go check that out.
Well, you mentioned the shortage of antivirals and vaccines. Tell us what the state of the vaccine supply is today as you see it.
Well, I think that the state of the influenza vaccine supply is really a mess, and it's unfortunate. Sometimes it seems, some years it seems like we have too much, and sometimes mm-hmm. it seems like we don't have enough. And the way that vaccine is developed and produced and how that gets to market is real complex. But I think the real problem that we have is we can't get the supply and distribution right during seasonal influenza. How are we ever going to get it right when we have pandemic influenza? So we're in big trouble if an avian strain surfaces that turns into a pandemic. It's not that there won't be enough vaccine to begin with. I think that there will be product there, but how do we get it to the places that need it? Mm-hmm. How do we make decisions about who gets it is going to be really, really tough. And then there's always the question of, do we have enough people to get the vaccine we've developed in people's arms? Mm-hmm. We know mm-hmm. there's a nursing shortage right now. We know that health departments aren't full to the brim with people sitting on their hands. Everybody's mm-hmm. real busy and tapped. We don't have the kind of workforce mm-hmm. we need to even distribute vaccine if we needed to get it to everybody. So we have some real things to work on with vaccine supply. We have to work on a more transparent vaccine supply process so that when it leaves the manufacturer, we know who's getting what, when, and where. During the influenza shortage we had a couple years ago, it was close to impossible mm-hmm. for us mm-hmm. to find out what communities had too much vaccine and what communities needed more. And how do we broker that vaccine in an emergency? Mm-hmm. It's really mm-hmm. important and something we don't want to have to figure out in the middle of a pandemic. We also need to be able to track where vaccine goes so that health departments can work with distributors and other purchasers of vaccine to make sure that those who really, really need it get it. And there isn't a good process for doing that right now. We've been working with the Centers for Disease Control, with our state partners around this issue, and it's a real complicated one. I always go back whenever I can, when we talk about vaccine, that we've become a little complacent. Public health has done a great job with some of these real complex problems, but there's no magic bullet. Mm-hmm. And in a pandemic, we're not going to have the vaccine supply that we need. The best vaccine, I think, is going to be public education mm-hmm. and risk communication mm-hmm. about how to keep ourselves healthy and what to do if we don't feel well. Mm-hmm. That's going to be our best strategy.
Now, that leads me to some questions on your thoughts as regards to medical surge capacity and capability generally. Can you tell us what local public health communities in particular have done the best job in addressing this challenge?
Well, I think there's a number of places across the country that have developed some really neat campaigns for pandemic influenza, for vaccine strategies. one of the things that we have to share is our toolbox, mm-hmm. our what we call EQUIP toolbox. It's an online clearinghouse of plans, procedures, tools that have been developed at the local level that others can use. And I think there's a lot in there related to pandemic influenza that folks will want to look at. And again, that's on our website, the NACHO.org website. One of the things that I think is important is to begin to develop a local plan. Don't wait for the federal government to come up with its plan. The federal government currently has a national strategy for pandemic mm-hmm. influenza, but that's the plan for the federal government. What is the federal government going to do mm-hmm. in a pandemic? It's not a plan for what states and locals are going to do mm-hmm. in a pandemic. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really important that local communities take this seriously, that they work together to come up with a plan, and that these issues of vaccine, antiviral supply are real tough issues that have to mm-hmm. be dealt with community by community. The success of our public health system in pandemic influenza is going to be determined by community by community. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be by releasing a 400-page national pandemic influenza strategy. Mm-hmm. It's going to be communities sitting down together trying to figure out some of these tough issues.
Mm-hmm. So I guess in conclusion on that, the planning guidance that came from the Santa Clara and Seattle King County efforts, the APCs there, would be a good starting point reference.
Yeah, it's one of the few tools that's out there, mm-hmm. and it was developed by peers for peers. Mm-hmm. You know, there's that quotation that we always use, which is, I think it was Eisenhower that said, you know, plans are useless, but planning is invaluable.
Yeah.
And I don't think we're ever going to come up with the cookbook plan. And there's never going to be a perfect plan. But that process of thinking through who some of the partners need to be at the table, how many folks involve churches, libraries, mm-hmm. businesses, hospitals, public health departments, plus all the traditional first responders in a planning process, getting mm-hmm. folks around the table and thinking about action steps together is really mm-hmm. what's important, not mm-hmm. what they write down on the piece of paper.
Understood. Well, Mike, thank you so much for your time, and thank you and NACHO for your service to our country.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
This has been a Domestic Preparedness podcast interview. Thank you for listening.